Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, money and the fight over charter schools. We'll look at who's given the more than $17 million sloshing around the coffers of groups battling over question two. And rethinking parenthood away from a model immortalized in that 70s show.
Look, in order for Eric to be a happy, well-adjusted adult, he has to be miserable now. That's just good parenting.
Why it's time to stop parenting and just be good parents. Also today, two places where Boston is on the cutting edge. Scott Kersner talks to us about how the city's become a hotbed of the cybersecurity industry. And in the world of cancer research, the new head of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
This is the most exciting time for cancer ever that I think we can all remember. I am just filled with optimism for the future of cancer.
It's Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Follow the money. True for anything in politics, especially true for the fight over ballot question two, the November referendum here in Massachusetts on whether to expand the number of charter schools in the state. Now, groups for and against question two had to file their most recent financial disclosure reports with the state just a few days ago. These are the so-called 60th day preceding election reports. And the numbers are staggering. Groups wanting to lift the charter school cap have collected more than $10 million so far this year. Groups opposing charter expansion collected more than $6 million. And in both cases, even more staggering, more than 98% of the money in both cases was donated by a tiny handful of individuals and organizations. So let's look deeper into the numbers with Maurice Cunningham. He's been examining the financial story behind the charter school battle for some time now. He's also a professor of political science at UMass Boston. He joins us in the studio. Professor Cunningham, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me on, Meghna.
Okay, so 60 days out, here we are. What really caught your eye the most with these latest filings over question two?
Well, for the committee Great Schools Massachusetts, the thing that jumped out at me was how much of the money is out of New York. About 70% of the money they've collected is out of New York, about 17% out of Massachusetts. Most of it untraceable. 85% of the money Great Schools Mass has raised is untraceable money. We will never know who those contributors are. And by the way, only 12 contributors have contributed most of that money, $8.1 million.
Okay, so let's take our little scalpel and go into this a little bit deeper. First of all, Great Schools Massachusetts is one of the groups in support of question two. They seek to lift the cap on charter schools in Massachusetts. That dark money you're talking about is coming from a group called Families for Excellent Schools Advocacy. And in these most recent filings, they had donated some $5.75 million out of the roughly $8.1 million that Great Schools Massachusetts had reported. That's the numbers that I added up together here.
That's what I have, $5.75 million, 71% of all contributions.
And why are you calling it dark money?
Because we'll never be able to find out who gave that money. Families for Excellent School Advocacy is what is called a 501c4 organization under the Internal Revenue Code. They are allowed to take contributions which are will remain anonymous to voters. They're a social welfare group. So for a 501c4, and they're not the only such group involved here, we will never know who those contributors are.
Based out of New York City, but again, because we can't know who's donating to them, the money could be coming from anywhere. It could be coming from right here in Massachusetts.
I suspect, based on what on the giving pattern for the public charter schools campaign here in Massachusetts, which at the end of 2015 was all Massachusetts-based multimillionaires and billionaires, they've disappeared from the giving list. I have no way of knowing who gives to Families for Excellent Schools Advocacy, but I think likely people are those Massachusetts millionaires and billionaires who have just seemed to have disappeared in the last few months.
Okay, so hold that thought because I want to come back to it in just a second, but I do want to let listeners know that We at Radio Boston called Families for Excellent Schools Advocacy, again, this New York-based group that has donated $5.75 million to Yes on Question 2. They did not return our calls or emails. Professor Cunningham, so there's some other names on the Yes on 2 side that popped out at me. A couple other of these sort of generically named groups: Strong Economy for Growth, Education Reform Now, Expanding Educational Opportunities, giving anywhere from $500,000 to $250,000. Then there's John Arnold, Centaurus Advisors from Texas, Michael Bloomberg, I also saw as well, and a couple of folks from the Walton family.
That surprised me as I was looking through this. The Walton family, there's a group, another ballot committee called Campaign for Fair Access to Quality Public Schools. Two of the Waltons have sent money their way. In fact, 80% of the money is from the Waltons that group has. Two Waltons have contributed $1.8 $2 million to that group. It's a large figure, and Waltons aren't traditionally involved in Massachusetts politics.
Interesting. I mean, they're out of Bentonville, Arkansas, right? And again, these are the Waltons of Walmart.
The Walmart family, not John Boy. No, these are the extraordinarily, endlessly rich Walton family.
Interesting. So again, this is the group Campaign for Fair Access to Quality Public Schools, and as you said, Jim and Alice Walton, having given $1.8 million out of the roughly $2.29 million that group has. On the business side of things, I see EMC, Partners Healthcare, The Kraft Group, and Vertex giving a total of $325,000 to expanding educational opportunities.
Yes, that's another group, and to their credit, they're corporations, but at least we know who they are. They're a sizable contributor, but not the most sizable contributor. But again, we know who they are at least.
Now, I want to talk to you about the No on Two folks in just a second. But a minute or two ago, Professor Cunningham, you had talked about how the fact that, and in previous filings that you looked at, that there had been more individual names of Massachusetts donors to the Yes on Two side, and those particular names have disappeared in these most recent filings. Can you remind us about who a couple of those folks were?
Sure. One of them would be Joanna Jacobson, the head of Strategic Grant Partners, an organization that for several years has been funding the run-up to this campaign without any public acknowledgement, I think. Seth Klarman, one of the richest men in Massachusetts and, according to the Globe, the largest campaign contributor in New England. Mostly to Republicans and very conservative free market causes.
We called many of those people as well. Didn't get any response from them. What do you think it means that those names are not on these most recent filings?
I certainly don't think that it means they've given up on something they've been working on for years. I think it means that they are continuing to contribute, but funneling money through dark money organizations.
All right. So let's get back to the idea that we started out with here. And again, we're going to talk about the No on Two side here in just a second. But in terms of the Yes on Two side, according to my number crunching that I did, and let me know if your numbers fall in the same place, it's about 98% of all the money of the roughly $10.8 million, almost $11 million for the Yes on Two side has come from this New York group, Families for Excellent Schools Advocacy, plus just a small handful of other individual donors. What does that tell you?
12 contributors. It says that it's not very broad-based. These donors are almost all, without exception, hedge fund or other financial management giants. It's an astounding amount of money from very few people.
This is how our democracy works these days. Do you have a problem with that?
I have an enormous problem with this. I think we should be from the rooftops decrying this. What we have now is not only not a democracy and not just a plutocracy. We have a secret plutocracy, and that is an enormous threat to us.
Mm. Well, on the other side of things, on the No on Two side, the issue or the pattern is I should actually say kind of similar, because they have what, $6.78 million they've taken in from Save Our Public Schools, and 99.9% of that is from what, the Massachusetts Teachers Association, the National Education Association, the American Federation of Teachers.
It's all teachers union money. That's absolutely correct. Now, the difference is that money is raised from small contributions from union members and paychecks every week or 2 weeks, and not from 12 multimillionaires or billionaires.
And so what's the difference between that then and the concerns you have on the Yes on Two side?
Well, for instance, full disclosure, as an educator in the UMass system, I'm a union member. I didn't get a chance to go look at my last check to see what my contribution was to the union. But I assure you, nobody is going to return my phone calls because I made a contribution to the union. It's that small. People like me, and by the way, I take no position on the charter school campaign. I take a position on democracy and dark money. But it's small amount of money. Now, people will return the call from unions. There's no question about that. But there isn't an equivalence here. But the point of big money on both sides is accurate.
I mean, you know what I'm seeing missing here, just to buttress what you're saying, is on both sides, there were a couple dozen small donors as well in the, you know, $50, $100, $200 range. But if this is a battle, if question two is a battle over the future of public education in Massachusetts, I'm not hearing or seeing through donations the voices of the public.
You know, it's interesting. Neither side is engaged in that, at least not as far as raising money from the public. They're not trying to raise money from the public. You know, they're going back to where they know the money is. And in the case of the hedge fund managers and their own bank accounts and the unions from the union dues. And that's what they're relying on. It's not a public campaign in that sense at all.
Interesting. Well, and spending on both sides so far has been, the vast majority of the spending has been on advertising and
TV
media
advertising,
buys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for the most part.
Well, do we have another filing coming up before Election Day?
There'll be other filings coming up, but we'll be keeping a look at it. I expect that the money will keep rolling in on both sides.
Well, Maurice Cunningham, political science professor at UMass Boston and co-founder of and contributor to the political blog Mass Politics Profs, thanks so much for joining us today.
Lovely to be here, Megan. Thank you.
And by the way, we have links to all of these filings at our website, radioboston.org, and also continued reporting on this at wbur.org at our Edify blog as well. And by the way, speaking of charter schools, tomorrow we will be hosting a live debate on the charter school ballot question hosted by us here at Radio Boston. It's also with the Boston Globe and the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. It is the first in a four-part series of debates about all of the ballot questions, and we'll be hosting one every week. If you want to attend the debate at UMass Boston, go to wbur.org/events and register now. Tickets are limited, so get them while they last. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. For writer and child development expert Allison Gopnik, there's a problem with modern parenting, and it's the idea that being a parent is too much like work. According to Gopnik, for many parents, weighed down with how-to books and all the anxiety that comes along with reading them, raising kids comes with the goal of shaping them into a particular kind of person. She says that's bad for kids and parents, and that we need to rethink parenting altogether. And she's here to tell us how. Allison Gopnik is a professor of psychology and an affiliate professor of philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley. Her new book is The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children. Allison Gopnik, welcome to Radio Boston.
So glad to be here.
It's a delight to have you. And I have to say selfishly so, because I'm the parent of two small children, and I hope to learn a great deal from you in the next 20 minutes or so. All right. So tell us, I mean, you posit this interesting question or idea in the book, and that is that something went wrong in your mind when we started thinking of parenting as a thing, as a vocation. When did that happen, and what's wrong with that?
Well, it's interesting because even the very word parenting doesn't show up until about 1960, and it doesn't become popular until the 1970s or 80s in the United States. So the very idea that there was this cultural, the very idea that there's something that you could do called parenting and that it was a kind of goal-directed activities, a relatively recent idea. And as a scientist, I wrote the book starting out trying to summarize some of the really exciting new research about how children learn and why children are important and what relationships between parents and children are all about. And I was really struck by how different the picture that comes from all this fascinating new science is from that parenting picture, which itself is a pretty recent and parochial invention, but one that's become completely pervasive in our culture.
So describe to us how you see the parenting picture. What kind of picture is being painted?
Well, the idea is that you become a parent so you can do something called parenting. And parenting is really a kind of goal-directed work, and the goal is to shape an adult of a particular kind. So if you just do the right kind of parenting, which means using the right kind of techniques or expertise, you'll have a child who will come out to be the right kind of child, which means that they'll be the right kind of adult. And the literature is just pervasive with how to make your children grow up to be X, happy or successful or intelligent. It's a little unclear about exactly happier or more successful or more intelligent than whom.
Yeah.
But at least implicitly the idea is, well, maybe he's smarter than the other child next door who doesn't have a parent who's quite as dedicated to parenting.
Well, so this is what gets me, and I'm speaking here from you know, my N equals one sample size of myself, and that you quickly learn, you know, as soon as your kids are born, that they are individuals. They're very, you know, their growth is unpredictable and organic. And the idea that you can actually shape them according to some formula goes out the window very quickly, because that's the dose of reality that you get as soon as you become a parent, or at least I did. But nevertheless, and I include myself in this group, there's a vast number of people who cling to the idea that there is some kind of magic formula out there. Why do you think that is, even in the face of the reality of the child before you?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting is that the picture that comes out of the science, I think actually kind of fits our intuitions, as you describe them, better than the parenting picture. But the parenting picture still has a tremendous hold. I mean, not just on you, on me, I think on most middle-class parents. And my diagnosis is that something else happened at the end of the 20th century. What happened was that for the first time in human history, people were having children who hadn't had very much experience of caring for children. So one of the fascinating things that comes out of the science is that literally from the time we evolved as human beings, we evolved to have the entire village that's raising the children. That's one of the things that's most distinctive about us as human beings. And what that means is that for most of human history, you grew up watching other people caring for children, caring for your own younger siblings and cousins, and you kind of organically figured out how to do it. What happened at the end of the 20th century was you had people who knew very well how to go to school and go to work, didn't have very much experience at all of caring for children. So when they did have children, a natural thing to think was, okay, this is like going to school or going to work. If I read the right books, I take the right classes, I learn the right techniques, I'll do this well. I'll be good at it. And that interacted with the fact that the new science that developed in the same 30 years was telling everyone that children are learning a tremendous amount and that caregiving for children is tremendously important, both of which are true, but don't imply this kind of carpentry picture of, if I just shape the child the right way, they'll come out the way I want.
Well, can I offer just a little different perspective here? I mean, maybe for exactly the same reasons that you outlined, that the idea of the rise of parenting was a necessary thing, because it did fill a vacuum that society had created by family groups being, you know, shaped differently, and socioeconomics driving people in different directions, so that we weren't surrounded by opportunities for caregiving before becoming parents.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that's definitely the reason why that culture developed. The trouble is, I don't think that it's not very well supported by anything that we know from the science, and I don't think it's been practically very good for either parents or children. So we have this very strange thing where billions of dollars get spent on this parenting industry, and at the same time, parents are anxious and children are anxious in middle-class lives, and, you know, 20% of American children are still growing up in poverty. So even though I think the reason the culture developed was to try and fill that gap, I don't think it's done a very good job. And part of what I talk about in the book is the idea of trying to build new social institutions that can have some of the character of those extended families that were the source of caregiving when we originally developed as human beings.
I mean, in fact, in the book, you don't really mince your words at all. You write that parenting is a terrible invention, and it hasn't improved the lives of children and parents. And in some ways, it's arguably made them worse. So you mentioned the science a couple of times. I'd love to dive into what the science of child development, you know, tells us about about what parenting should be. I mean, the title of your book is The Gardener and the Carpenter, which is a way you describe two different sort of approaches to raising young people. Tell us about why you chose The Gardener and the Carpenter.
Well, as I said, the carpenter is a kind of nice model for this parenting picture that if you're enough of an expert, you can shape something to come out a particular way. But actually, I think a more profound thought is the thought that being a caregiver might be more like being a gardener. And that's in two respects. One is, at least if you're a gardener like me, you know that you work incredibly hard and you're up to your neck in manure a lot of the time, but nothing ever comes out exactly the way that you planned. And that is part of what's fantastic about gardening. But there's a deeper sense in which that's true, and that is that what you really need to do when you're a gardener is create an ecosystem. So what you want to do is create a nurturing environment in which lots and lots of different plants can flourish, in which you've got a resilient, varied, different kind of system of different kinds of plants. And what you have when you have a system like that, as opposed to just, you know, having the hothouse with the very best orchid, is that you have something that's robust, that's resilient, that can deal with change. And I think that's a very good model from a scientific perspective of what caregiving is all about, of why, for example, human beings have a much longer childhood and a much greater investment in caregiving than any other species. That investment didn't shape children to come out a particular way. What it did was allow human beings to have this incredibly varied ways of being in the world. It allowed each generation to really sort of invent the world fresh. And that's our great human, accomplishment. Mm. So it's a picture that certainly says caregiving is incredibly important, but it's important in a really different way than the kind of goal-directed parenting picture.
Well, we're speaking with Allison Gopnik. She's a professor of psychology and affiliate professor of philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley. She's author of The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children. And listeners would love to know what you think. What's your reaction to Allison Gopnik saying that parenting, this thing we call parenting, is a terrible invention? And do you see the gardener model in your life, with your families, in your schools? How would we have a garden when it comes to raising young people today? Call us with your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Allison Gopnik, take me even more deeply into the science here. So when we talk about the science, the new science of child development, and we have the metaphor of the gardener, what specifically does a gardener parent do that's in the best interest of a developing child?
Well, the kind of biological science that's developed, new ideas about how it is that humans evolve, emphasize this change in what we call life history, which means this very long period of childhood that we have, and all sorts of other things that go with it, like grandmothers, for example. My personal favorite discovery has been how important, even biologically, grandmothers were in the development of human beings. And the idea is that children are for learning. They're for mess. They're for diversity. That's what children in childhood are all about. And what caregiving does is give you a protected period where you can explore all these possibilities, all this novelty, without actually having to commit yourself to actually doing anything. You could think about children as being like the R&D division of the human species, and we grown-ups are like production and marketing. So they get this protected time when they can just explore. And our job as caregivers is to give them that protection that comes from that incredible committed love that we feel, and also to pass on our own culture and knowledge to those children. That's another function of the very point of childhood. But to do that, knowing that what they'll do is take those values, take those ideas, and do something completely unexpected and new. And that's exactly what caregiving is all about.
Hmm.
The other piece of the science is that we've found that, as you might expect from this picture, children are equipped with incredible learning capacities. And they're phenomenally good at figuring things out just from looking at the other people around them, being involved with them, and most of all, something we might have known all along, from playing. So just looking at other people doing the things they do, going out to the garden or going to fetch the laundry or shopping or doing all the things that grown-ups do, and lots of different grown-ups do, and just sitting and playing, those very simple things that, you know, we don't need very much parenting expertise to have kids sitting beside us while we're cooking or let them play with the mixing bowls. Those things, that's really where we see the incredible, powerful learning abilities of young children. And so, I think this is a very, I hope this is both reassuring and liberating for parents and caregivers.
Yeah. So in this sense, doesn't it give, I mean, to your point of liberation, doesn't it give hope to, for example, you know, the many people whose kids are in preschool, or even, you know, kids who are at home, because building this play-based environment, you know, again, I'm just speaking from personal experience, and a lot of the preschools that we looked around for our young sprouts, if I can call them that, like the ethos seemed to be play-based learning. I think that is a great deal of how an increasing number of preschools are approaching it.
Well, it's interesting because that was always the tradition in preschool education. After all, the very word kindergarten means child's garden.
Right.
But in fact, part of the other reason for writing the book was just as parents are under this terrible pressure and anxiety, preschools are under terrible pressure. And they're caught in a kind of pincer movement between parents, on the one hand, who believe in the parenting picture and want their children to go to Harvard, and policymakers, on the other, who feel like, well, we're willing to invest in early childhood education, but we want some evidence that our investment is worthwhile. And both of those forces have been making kindergartens and preschools more and more and more like schools, which, again, is ironic because it's exactly the opposite of what the science would suggest is the best way of providing children with opportunities for learning. A great preschool, and we have lots of models of this, like the Reggio Emilia program, the child study centers, some Montessori schools. We have lots of examples of this. A great preschool you could think of as really being the social institution that can replace that extended family village that we evolved to learn in. But the trouble is that instead of increasing that kind of model and supporting it more, we're actually putting a lot of pressure to get rid of that model, to make it more and more like school.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick call here. Megan is calling from Shirley. You're on the air, Megan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that the Gardner Method is very much like what I grew up with my own mother, and I'm so grateful for it because it was very relationship-oriented. Of course, my mom and my parents wanted good things for us, but it wasn't about them in, like, turning out a product. I feel like today it's all about turning out this ideal product. And I feel like for my own kids, the relationship gardener kind of thing, it's more focused on them. It's very dynamic and just enjoying who they are.
Well, I think that's a perfect description. And one of the other things I say in the book is I draw this contrast between parenting and being a parent. And I think it's interesting that, you know, we don't talk about husbanding our husbands or childing our parents or even friending our friends. We don't think that the point of those deep, important social relationships is to shape our husbands to come out better than they started, or at least not very often. Instead, we think that those deep relationships are equivalents. They're about being in a relationship with someone where they contribute something and you do. I talk in the book about it's like a conversation or like a dance where both partners are involved. Mm-hmm. And I think thinking about it as being a parent is a much better way, and as I say, a kind of liberating way, rather than thinking of it as this extra job on top of all the other jobs that you have to do.
Yeah. You know, you write in the book, again, we've been discussing the research, but there's a particular experiment that you wrote about that really caught my attention about a toy and that an experiment that it had children interact with a toy and that they learned more from just experimenting with the toy by themselves than being shown exactly what to do with it. So tell us what happened there.
Well, it's interesting. There's this whole fascinating line of research that shows that even 3- and 4-year-olds are very sensitive to quite subtle signals about is someone trying to shape them or teach them. And in this experiment, they gave the preschoolers that was actually done right here in Boston. They actually gave the preschoolers a toy that could do lots of different things. And no surprise to parents, when you just gave them the toy, they figured out every single thing that it could do just by messing around with it. But when the experimenter came in and said, this is my toy, I'm going to show you how it works, they did exactly what the experimenter did, but they didn't go on to discover all the other things that the toy could do. And we've done experiments like this in my lab. As I say, there's quite a lot of these experiments, and there's kind of two sides. One of them is just showing children, just giving children the world to explore. They are incredibly sophisticated at exploring it. You know, as I say, we've thought for a long time that play was important, but we're finally really beginning to show scientifically just how important it is and how sophisticated children's play really is. It's like being a little scientist doing experiments. But when children think that they're being taught, they behave kind of differently. And in some ways, it's very sensible, right? I mean, after all, if someone's teaching you, presumably they're telling you the things that you just need to know, not all these other things. But it does seem to narrow the range of options that children are considering.
It does make me wonder about, I mean, you touched on this earlier, but it feels like that just that one observation requires us to upend our entire model of what we think of school even should be.
Well, of course, one of the other many ironies of this is that school is a very strange institution. You know, it's very recent. It's only been around for a couple of hundred years. And it was really designed to fulfill the needs of industry in the 19th century. That's what it was about training people to be reasonable workers in factories. And in a world like ours where, you know, robots are going to do a lot of that work, what we really need is innovation and creativity. And the kind of traditional model of schools, as many people have pointed out, isn't very good at doing that. The irony is that the kind of natural learning abilities, the kind of paleo learning, if you will, that we see in these 3- and 4-year-olds are actually much better suited to innovation and creativity. And in fact, some of the research I talk about in the book that we've done in my lab shows that children often are better at finding creative solutions than adults are. They'll actually do better at figuring out something that's sort of initially unlikely. That's what they're about. So we're kind of squelching that in the service of a model that isn't even really a good model of what our future work is going to be like.
Huh. Let's take another quick call. Leah is calling from Lexington. You're on the air, Leah.
Hi. I've been listening to the show, and I'm wondering if you could explain how your book, where you use the analogy of the gardener and the carpenter, how that's different from what we've been hearing a lot in the media with the helicopter parent versus the free-range parent. And because I'm a parent of two boys, 9 and 11, I'm trying to find something in between. My natural tendency is to be towards the helicopter, and I'm trying to pull back. And I'm wondering what your book can, how much light it can shed for someone like me.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, I want to emphasize it's been a bit of a paradox when I've been talking about the book that writing a book that says that you shouldn't read parenting books, it's easy for people to say, yeah, okay, except what's your solution and formula? And I think the important point is you work out a relationship with children that lets you and that particular child thrive with all your idiosyncrasies and eccentricities. And that can be tremendously different for different parents and different children. And that, again, from a scientific perspective, is part of the whole point. So I think the important thing is not to have a prescription one way or another. The whole point of the book is that those prescriptions don't have very much scientific basis. The point is to try to create a relationship between a particular adult, a particular caregiver, and a particular child that lets them both thrive in a satisfying way at the time that you're being a caregiver, rather than trying to think about what is the thing that I should do that in the long run will make my child come out a particular kind of way.
You know, Allison, to that point, there's a passage in your book where you write that, quote, gardening is risky and often heartbreaking, and every gardener knows the pain of watching that most promising of sprouts wither unexpectedly. Now, that kind of stopped me when I read it because I thought, okay, I understand what you're getting at here. There's risks to every kind of approach when it comes to caregiving. Mm-hmm. But to a point you made earlier, we're living in a society right now that, you know, whether realistically or not, parents feel certain pressures, right? They want mm-hmm. their kids to be able to get to certain schools, and we're not just talking the Harvards of the world, you know, and they want mm-hmm. them to be able to springboard into a job that will get them a good wage and security, and they're concerned about inequality and the rising inequality between haves mm-hmm. and haves not. There just seems to be a lot of pressure that make the tolerating the risk of, quote, watching that most promising of sprout wither unexpectedly just an intolerable risk.
Yeah, I mean, I can completely sympathize with that. And, you know, parents have always desperately wanted the best for their children. That's part of what being a parent is all about. But, you know, there's something, I think there's actually something sort of morally profound. And again, something I think we have the intuition about, which is parenting is also, being a parent is also about letting children go. And it's a very strange relationship because you start out with this totally dependent child who literally you're holding all the time. And you end up with this person who can make their own decisions, and some of them might be good and some of them might be bad. And if their life is going to be like most human lives, it'll be full of joy and triumph and disaster and disappointment. And the kind of paradox is that your job is to, if there isn't some chance that your child fails, you haven't actually succeeded as a parent, because the point about being a parent is to allow enough risk and independence and autonomy, and risk and independence and autonomy come with the possibility of failure. In some ways, I recognize that that's difficult, but in some ways, I think it ought to be comforting for parents. What the story is that what you do as a parent is do everything you can, loving and nurturing this particular child, and then in some ways, the rest of it is up to the child. And that's what makes being a parent such a morally profound experience. And mm-hmm. And again, the sort of paradox is that by trying to completely control things, you end up with a worse outcome than you would if you just managed to let go.
Well, I have to say that my two kids are my greatest teachers every day in this process as well. Allison Gopnik, professor of psychology and affiliate professor of philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley. The new book is The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children. What a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There's a bonfire going on in Boston. Okay, not a real one, but that's just how Boston Globe innovation economy columnist Scott Kersner describes the region's ballooning cybersecurity industry. Dozens of startups, a steady flow of venture capital, not to mention a highly educated workforce, all have made Boston an epicenter of the cybersecurity industry, and Scott is here now to tell us more. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me here.
Okay, so a bonfire. Meaning?
I like the bonfire metaphor to sort of describe something that Boston does really well, and we should maybe pour a little more gasoline and, you know, get the s'more, get the marshmallows and get the chocolate and graham crackers going. You know, we often don't market ourselves well enough here in the Boston tech scene, but cybersecurity is one of those areas where there's just a lot going on. It's not the kind of stuff that the typical computer user or consumer comes into contact with, because there you think about maybe Symantec or McAfee or these companies that protect your personal computer. But what Boston does really well is protect corporate databases and corporate data centers.
Okay, really important, because they're very, very frequently the target of hackers, right?
Yeah, and there were three, you know, there was sort of a trifecta of events that got me thinking about writing this piece. And one of them was almost on Christmas Eve last year, the Ukrainian power grid got hacked, presumably by the Russians, and taken down. So that's sort of a scary thing if hackers can turn off the power at will. Then there was this hack of the Central Bank of Bangladesh, where they basically sucked out $80 million before anybody knew what was going on. And the third one, of course, was this summer when, you know, Donald Trump maybe allegedly suggested that, hey, the Russians should do another hack after the Democratic National Committee hack and try to hunt down some more Hillary Clinton deleted emails. So I had, you know, hacking is clearly in the popular consciousness right now. And so I wanted to look at some of the Boston companies that are trying to, you know, present a line of defense.
Okay, so before we talk about those companies specifically, Boston Business Journal said that in a recent cybersecurity survey of many major markets, this was done by Deloitte in 2015, 50% of those surveyed in Boston said that their company had experienced incidents, cyber incidents of such a magnitude that it ultimately required executive attention. So there's a huge need for this.
Yeah, and companies don't always. People may remember there was a TJ Maxx hack maybe 8 or 10 years ago that was in the news a lot. But a lot of times companies are aware that somebody is trying to break into their systems or is sort of hunting around for vulnerabilities, and they may not have to disclose that in a press release or disclose that to the public because no credit card numbers or no healthcare data or something sensitive was taken. But companies are really aware that there's a lot of snooping around happening in their systems.
Hmm. So tell us about some of the companies in the Boston area that epitomize this bonfire of cybersecurity development.
Well, you know, they're all benefiting from the phenomenon that you mentioned, which is that businesses are really paranoid about winding up in the headlines and being the next target. And so it's almost like, this is one of those areas where businesses spend really, really freely or invest, I guess they would say, really freely in, you know, the belt and suspenders approach of we really want to protect our data. So the one technology company that we had here in Massachusetts that went public in 2015 was a cybersecurity company called Rapid7 mm-hmm. that's in Boston. It's now worth $750 million on the market. And what one of the things that they do is help companies realize more quickly that someone has broken in, you know, like they help you spot the broken window in your house more quickly and then patch it up, because the longer hackers have access to the systems, the more damage they can do. But there are also really interesting companies like Veracode, which is a system that software developers use as their writing software to make sure that they're not leaving any openings for hackers to exploit once that software code is up and running on a website or a mobile app. So it's kind of like a, you know, almost spell check for software developers to make sure that they're not creating any problems.
Yeah. You know, so this is really interesting, Scott, because it seems as if the mix that's gone into making Boston such a fertile ground for these cybersecurity companies, as we mentioned before, highly educated workforce, lots of startups in the same ecosystem, and that steady flow of venture capital funding. Now, that's something that's a little different than previous conversations you and I have had about startups in different sectors that are dying to get VC money here and just can't get it.
Yeah, I mean, this is really the way that cybersecurity works. So you could almost rewind the clock 15 or 20 years, and it would sort of feel like the software world and the technology world felt like a decade and a half or so ago, because, you know, it's based on academic research coming out of MIT or Harvard. We have the venture capitalists locally, firms like there's one that's called 406 Ventures. It's sort of an homage to Ted Williams and his greatest season as a Red Sox slugger. So we have the venture capitalists here. We also have a lot of financial services and healthcare companies here in Boston that are those paranoid customers who say...
Yeah, you don't have to go far to look for those
customers.
Yeah,
you know, drive across the Charles River and you can knock on a door in the Longwood Medical area and there's someone who's probably worried about the threat that your little startup is addressing. And the last thing is that, you know, these are still companies that have sales forces that go out and knock on doors of the Fortune 500 and want to talk to the CISO, the Chief Information Security Officer, which is kind of a new role. And so it's not, it's not like a Dropbox type of company where you go to the website and you put in your credit card number and you buy this product. These are things where it's still a sales force that's going out and shaking hands and, you know, taking people to golf.
Hmm. Now, how large is the cybersecurity industry as a whole?
It's big, you know, $75 billion, I think, is the market research for the global market today. And it's expected to more than double to $170 billion by 2020. So I think what's driving this is that, you know, we have more and more devices that are connected to the internet and are hackable in some way,
yeah.
Not just the tablet and the PC and the smartphone that you have at home or use for work, but even smart refrigerators are now hackable, and you could potentially get a login, a login name or a password from somebody's smart fridge. Connected cars, too. There are demos of cars being hacked and data being sucked off of them or even control being taken. So, you know, this is the flip side of everything in our lives having connectivity from the wristwatch to the fridge, is that we have to protect everything.
Yeah, so more potential room for growth for Boston companies looking to get into the cybersecurity sector. It also makes me think that if you're looking for a new job, maybe becoming a cybersecurity expert isn't a bad way to go.
No, I learned a new term, which is pen tester, penetration tester. It's somebody who sits around all day and tries to break into stuff. So that might be my next job.
Well, Scott Kirsner is the innovation economy columnist for the Boston Globe, talking to us about why Boston's suddenly a hotbed city for white hats when it comes to cybersecurity. Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks, Meghna.
All right, let's move over to another area where Boston institutions are on the cutting edge, and that's cancer treatment. The incoming president of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute met with Boston media for the first time this morning, and she talked about the future of cancer. WBUR's Carrie Goldberg was there, and she's with us now. Hi there, Carrie.
Hey, Meghna. And yes, Dr. Lori Glimcher takes the reins at Dana-Farber on October 1st, and she did speak briefly to reporters today. Dr. Glimcher has been an immunologist for 35 years. She's been at Harvard and Cornell, and she's on Vice President Biden's Blue Ribbon Panel on the Cancer Moonshot that's underway at the federal level. So she really does have the big picture. And I thought, you know, for a topic as complex as cancer, she summed up the future very succinctly.
Succinctly. Okay. So what did she say?
So here's the path forward as she sees it.
I think the future of cancer treatment is going to be, as it was for HIV/AIDS, combination therapy. We need to figure out how we combine drugs that target the tumor itself with therapeutics that also activate our immune system.
So to start with the second part, she's talking there about immunotherapy. And, you know, that's something we've talked about here on Radio Boston before. As you know, it's pretty much the hottest thing in cancer these days. And it involves harnessing our own immune system to fight the cancer, to take off the brakes, so to speak, that the cancer puts on. And Dr. Glimcher says the key is combining these new immunotherapy treatments with ways to kill the tumor itself. And those would include, you know, the familiar cancer treatments we're used to hearing about, like chemo and
radiation.
Yep, and targeted drugs. And there were other speakers at Dana-Farber today, too. One was Dr. Gordon Freeman, who is a big pioneer in immunotherapy. And he had a very similar message. He was talking about one very successful form of immunotherapy that targets a molecule called PD-1. But he says there are a lot more in the pipeline.
And now that we know PD-1 immunotherapy works, all these other molecules that up or down regulate the immune response are drug targets. And multiple pharma companies and academic scientists are researching these and finding out which ones work. And many of them do work better. And so the future really is combination therapy. We've basically got the door open.
So there it is again, Carrie, that phrase, combination therapy. But the door open still means that you got to walk through it, though.
You got to walk through. There's masses more to figure out, including, of course, which combinations of which therapies work best. And the immune system is so complicated. So I asked Dr. Freeman if what he meant was that there might be not just one cure for cancer, but maybe thousands of cures for cancer. And he said, no, I was off by an order of magnitude, that there may be something like 75 documented combinations of therapies so far that have already have published results. And the key now, of course, is to do more clinical trials to figure out what's really safe and what does work best.
Well, and what works best for individuals, right? Because we've heard that while some immunotherapies work great for some patients, mm-hmm. Former President Jimmy Carter, right? And his melanoma, which was, cured actually by immunotherapy.
Seemed to be.
But they don't work at all for other individuals.
Right. And the estimates are that very generally, immunotherapy maybe works for between 15 or 20 and 40% of the patients who try it. So it is a game changer, but it's by no means a full-fledged cure for cancer in general. And, you know, similarly, the moonshot isn't promising a cure for cancer either. It's just trying to make the research go a lot faster to try to do maybe what would have taken 10 years in 5. But, Meghna, at the same time, I have to say it's pretty striking to hear a longtime expert like Dr. Lori Glimcher, this new chief of the Dana-Farber, sounding like this.
This is the most exciting time for cancer ever that I think we can all remember. I am just filled with optimism for the future of cancer. The excitement around the country, around the world, is really palpable now. The community is energized, we're poised, and we are devoted to collaboration among different institutions to make this work.
So pretty striking, yeah. Right? Heartening, even though, of course, there is so far to go. And one of the other researchers who spoke at Dana-Farber today was the director of the Melanoma Center, Dr. Stephen Hody. He said that, you know, what's been figured out so far about immunotherapy is sort of like just the first chapter in what's going to be a very long novel.
But hopefully a novel with a happy ending, though.
Right.
But, you know, Carrie, I was really taken by that piece of tape we heard from Dr. Glimcher to hear her say this is the most exciting time for cancer ever. It's very optimistic. Mm-hmm. But haven't we heard similar refrains since, what, the Nixon era and the war on cancer then? I mean, I don't mean to poo-poo this, but I do feel like every few years there is talk about a giant leap forward in cancer research.
Yeah, and instead it turns out to be the sort of chiseling away of little pieces of cancer, right? Like better treatments for this one or that one. So I think that's the question at this point is, will cancer really become like HIV, as Dr. Glimcher hopes, or will it remain a disease that cuts so many lives short?
And the key, again, as she was saying, is combination therapy.
Combination therapy. We're going to be watching that.
We'll hear a lot more about it. Well, mm-hmm. Carrie Goldberg is editor of WBUR's Common Health blog, talking to us about the next steps in cancer research with the new head of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Carrie, thanks so much.
Welcome.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.